Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 17th of February 2013. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Nick from Partially Abstracted View, and Johnny Fox. We're now going to talk about The Stepmother, which is a UK premiere of a play by Geeta Sowerbury, directed by Sam Walters at the Orange Tree Theatre. Geeta Sowerbury is in the news quite a lot because there's a rather major touring production of Rutherford and Son, which has been partially adapted by Blake Morrison, and it's been directed by Jonathan Miller. So it's quite a lavish production, and it's touring all around the country, and it's got a lot of good press. This has sort of crept in the way that the Orange Tree shows do, and it's actually getting just as good a reviews. It's a very impressive piece, rather sort of domestic, written in 1924. It's about the stepmother of the title is very fond of her charges, but she's kind of been... It seems that she's almost been tricked into marriage by Eustace, a rather caddish figure. Not a classic cad. He's actually weak and whiny and a rather terrible person, but he has taken her on board when she was she used to be the companion of his sister, and he sort of takes her on as the governess to the girls and subsequently marries her. We see a prologue set in 1911, and then a dozen years later we get about 10 years later we get the full play. So in the prologue we see her as this sort of rather lost 19-year-old girl. We see her being sort of taken in, having inherited a very large amount of money from Eustace's sister. And he obviously takes over her life because they're married 10 years later, and you know she's running a small business, quite a successful business in London, and she's seems to have successfully brought up his two daughters. Meanwhile, he is embezzling her money and losing it. We sort of have an idea of it. One of the things I found very impressive about this production, and I think this is a very impressive production, was surprised from Christopher Ravenscroft. I always think of him as a rather nice character, and he's playing in this whiny man who is weak but blames his weakness on other people and is able to make his wife feel as if it's all her fault. And it is a very impressive production. I did have actually recommended all the contributors going to see it. Now, one of the contributors who did see it is Gareth. What did you think about this?
Well, big thank you, really, because I absolutely loved it. I had seen Rutherford and Son before because it was given an outing at the National Theatre in 1994 in the Cotswolds. And that was her one big hit, really. It was produced at the Royal Court. They changed her first name to initials so that people didn't know it was a woman, because they thought it'd be panned, and it turned out to be a big success, and it's therefore quite an important play. And the production of the National, even though it was by Katie Mitchell before she turned deconstructionist, was very good, and I'm looking forward very much to seeing the Jonathan Miller one. But this is at least as good a play, and it's just baffling that it's been sitting there unproduced for 90 years. It's incredibly well structured. The characters are really well drawn, the story is really quite complex, and it's quite multi-layered. It starts with the beginning of the story is a bit unusual, I think, and if anything, perhaps even a little bit unlikely that, you know, there would be this widow with two daughters who would have a 17-year-old companion who she'd then leave all her money to. It seemed a bit implausible, really. And that takes up the longer first half. And I think it's in the second half, when the girls have grown up and she's been married for 10 or so years now to Eustace, who took her in, is absolutely a brilliant, brilliant piece of staging. And I think a brilliant piece of writing, because in the space of an hour, you know, the twists and turns and it was so dramatic at one point, and so intense in that very small, very intimate space where you're right on top of it. It was so dramatic that people were just kind of, I mean, almost joining in. I mean, there were people sort of gasping and commenting, And particularly, I think, because of the acting of Christopher Ravenscroft, as you mentioned. I mean, he's so completely believable as this this character who's very manipulative and very self-centered. The people were really turning against him as if it was Eustace there in front of them. So I thought it was, I think it's a great play, even though I might have got the beginning wrong. I think it's a great play. I think that it's been very, very well staged in the round there. The space suits it very much because it gives it that, it gives you that sort of involvement in the show and some brilliant acting. I mean, in addition to Crystal Ravensroth, then Katie McGuinness, who plays Lois, the stepmother is just terrific because she has to, you know, she has a lot of emotionality to handle in the role and she does that very delicately. And the two girls when they're older, the two actresses to play the girls when they're older, Jennifer Higham and Nellamy Tucker are both very, very good indeed as well. So I thought it was a great night out.
Getting quite a lot of the cast in the next play that they're doing at the Orange Tree. They're holding over quite a few of the cast, so it's almost like a rep in some ways, I think.
Well, if you look at their biographies in the programme, the vast majority of them have done multiple plays at the Orange Tree, and the Orange Tree does have a lot of actors who clearly enjoy working there, are very loyal to it, and go back over and over again, really. I think what puzzles me about this is why it hasn't been revived, particularly as, you know, I mean, her contemporaries included people like Shaw, and for me, this is a better play than probably anything Shaw wrote. I mean, and I suppose it's just, you know, if you don't find something, then you don't produce it. And if you only had one performance at the time, just had one performance when it was first written, and I suppose there therefore wouldn't be that many records of it. I am assuming it isn't published. I don't know. She only wrote, I think, four plays, and I think Rutherford and Son is the only one that's had a production longer than the one performance that this got, and the other two, I believe, are unproduced. So I would really like to see someone going digging and trying to find those, really.
Yeah, and it's a kind of one where you do wish that they would, because they hardly ever transfer Orange Tree stuff, and it's a pity because this one could do well in a much bigger place. Although it probably does help if it was still in the round, which cuts down the number of plays it could, you know, places it could run in. But they could, you know, probably adapt it quite easily.
Yeah,
but I do hope it get. You know, I do, as you say, I hope it enters the repertoire in some way, so that people, you know, people pay more attention to it. But I mean, that's something that the Orange Tree has always done, isn't it?
Well, and particularly, I think the Orange Tree is kind of specialised in early 20th century playwrights, and perhaps even late 19th century playwrights, and has done great work digging out all sorts of plays that we haven't seen anywhere else. And here's yet another example, really.
We're now going to talk about Our Country's Good, which is on at the St. James's Theatre in London. This is Timberlake Wurtenbecker's a play which was written really to accompany a production of The Recruiting Officer. It was sort of the idea of Max Stafford Clarke at the Royal Court 25 years ago, and something he's repeated a few times since, is to take a classic play, in this case The Recruiting Officer, and produce some kind of reply to it. So you get Our Country's Good. They did She Stoops to Conquer and No Laughing Matter, I think, as another one. He's done it a few times. This one, though, has had quite a lot of legs, Our Country's Good, and he's sort of revived it a few times. I think I saw the 10-year revival, and I saw the production after they toured worldwide with it, and the 10-year revival, but I haven't quite seen this one yet. The play is about a cast of convicts and officers who put on the first Western play in America, in Australia, and that play happened to be The Recruiting Officer, so, which is why they paired it. The play, I believe, is based on Keneally's book, The Playmaker, which deals with the real life story of many of the characters in this. It seems to have got quite well reviewed. Nick, what did you think about it?
Yeah, I thought this was a strong production. It's actually only about less than a year since I first saw the play, because it toured in a slightly smaller tour last year, smaller touring company. So wasn't one I'd seen until then, and so I still kind of had my first impressions of the play still in my mind. But I can see why it's had legs, as you say. It's also apparently pretty much a set text now for I think A-level drama rather than A-level English, and I can see why, because it's such a commentary on theatre itself. And not just, its main purpose is obviously the commentary is on the power of art to redeem people and to improve people's lives. But it's also, there's commentary within the play on the way theatre is made. There's a lot of doubling, which I imagine is actually, I assume it's written down who's going to double who, because the doubling was exactly the same as the production I saw last year. And the fact of there being doubling is commented on, because it also happens in the play within a play. So it's kind of meta, and it's kind of about the making of theatre and about the meaning of theatre. So I can absolutely see why it's become known as this classic that it has. And I think this is a very, very strong production. It's very well cast. I mean, there's a lot of, I think what I described as faces that kind of people who watch telly won't have recognised, but people who go to the theatre a lot will definitely be excited to see. And it's hard to pick people out, really, because it's just a very, very evenly well cast piece. And I'm probably not sounding quite as enthusiastic about it as I should, but it is absolutely worth seeing. And it's, one real sign for me is there was, I think they were actually A-level students doing studying the play, but there was quite a few school groups there the night that I went, and they were absolutely enraptured by it. I think they came in with quite strong feelings about the play because they studied it, and they were absolutely satisfied by what they got in the stage version. I think they were possibly surprised by some of the casting. It wasn't quite what they had in their heads, but they were totally sold on it. And you can't say much better than when there's what might could have been a difficult audience, and they're absolutely silent and really just sucked into everything in there. It's a very well written piece. And it has its flaws, which are they're understandable when you hear a lot about how the writing of it was quite chaotic. It was kind of written as it was being rehearsed and rewritten, and there are elements in it. The sort of the attempt at a kind of romance storyline doesn't really work, and there's really very, considering what a nightmare apparently it was to get it written and performed, it's an incredibly solid, incredibly strong piece. And I think this is not a radical production of it, but it's a straight down the line excellent production of it.
Yeah, I think I read the Max Defoe-Clark's book Letters to George, in which he talks about the writing of this. I mean, it is something he did quite a lot, certainly when he was working with Carol Churchill, where they come up with a basic plot which is handled by the writer, and then the actors go away and they do a lot of research. I think that's a place like Cloud Nine. You get a lot of that came out of this kind of process. And Cloud Nine by Carol Churchill, and that came out of this process. And I think this is it is an interesting process, I think. Gareth, what did you think about the play?
Well, even though the school kids at my performance were also rapt, unfortunately they were also rustling. So I had to move seats twice to get away from the noise. But, you know, they were paying attention. They seemed to be able to rustle text and pay attention at the same time. I haven't seen this since the original production, and I think I enjoyed it more, actually, than the original production. Although I did miss not seeing the two together. But it is less than a year since we saw the recruiting officer anyway at the Donmar. So the play would have been, I've been re-familiarised with the play, that the play within the play, as it were, quite recently. I feel what struck me this time is how the story of how we transported people at that period of time comes through very strongly. The harshness of the regime that would, you know, send someone to Australia for 7 years for stealing £2 or something. Kind of came over to me much more this time, and the diverse range of people who were subject to that transportation. Clearly, the sort of, you know, the redemptiveness of theatre comes over. Also very well. In a way, I feel I'm better placed to see the play now because I've seen a lot of work in prisons in the last 10 years, which has kind of, you know, given me another view on the power of theatre in rehabilitation, really. And I also sort of touched on the transportation and Australian convict issue in visiting some of the former prisons there in Australia since the last time I saw this play as well, really. So I kind of think it's probably the same play done very well, but I got more out of it this time round, I think, than I did last time round. It is very, very well acted, and I think almost everybody doubles or triples up in roles. I particularly liked Dominic Thorburn, who was the second lieutenant who actually directs the play within the play and has the romantic relationship that is a bit implausible. But I also liked Laura Dos Santos, who did a great job in, I think it was Educating Rita, wasn't it, at the Menier, who plays a convict, Mary Brennan, who has to have a particularly extraordinary journey for her in the play because of the play within the play, really. And I thought those two were really, really very, very good indeed. So, I mean, time has, as you know, 20 years almost have elapsed, and it's proved to have been a classic, and it's proved to pack as much a punch today, if not more of a punch today, than it did 20 years ago. And in one of the program notes, you know, when you read the program notes and realize we've now got 50% more prisoners today than we had when this play was first staged, that kind of also resonates somewhat when you consider the subject matter of the play, really. So very enjoyable and to be recommended. And this is the first, I think, the first big hit that the St. James's Theatre have had, although I suppose Cinderella was a reasonable hit as well. I've been to this theatre, and I'm beginning to sort of, even though it's very steep and there's not much legroom, I'm beginning to sort of like the space in terms of how it plays a stage there, really. So I wouldn't have any hesitation in recommending this to people.
Yeah, I might have to see it. I have to say I was rather reluctant to do it, but not because I don't like the play or because I don't like the director. I do like the director. I just wish he wouldn't keep trotting out these old hits. It's kind of I always wanted to see him do something new, but he perhaps doesn't get enough attention when he does, because he does, you know, he's constantly putting stuff out, Mike Stafford-Clarke, and he's such a good director, I think.
Out of Joint has lost quite a bit of funding, and, you know, he has to, financially, I suspect, you know, there is a financial imperative behind putting on something that's a set text in schools. And also, you know, I mean, he's beyond normal retirement age, if there's such a thing anymore. And, you know, and I think one can understand that he might want to sort of look back and revisit some of his better work, really. So I'm not sure I feel the same about that. And I didn't know it had had that many revivals, to be honest. So for me, just sort of coming back after 20 years seemed like a wholly appropriate revival. But if it has been done a few times since then obviously I hadn't quite clocked that, really.
We're now going to talk about Money, the game show at the Bush Theatre. This is a play by Claire Duffy and is performed by Lucy Ellenson and Brian Ferguson. The idea of this play, it is somewhat interactive, is we have two hedge fund managers, Queenie and Casino, who divide the audience into two. You're given a random number at the beginning, and if it's odd, you go one way, and if it's even, you go another way. And they have you as teams, and they basically talk you through the financial crisis, sort of from a personal point of view. And we get some fun games, and then it turns very serious towards the time of the crash, after they've explained how got to the crash, and there's a rather nasty rather nasty thing happens to one of them. I think it happens to a different one depending on who wins or loses the games. And we see it, the person, the nasty thing happens, and the person sort of takes on the image of the economy, of the world economy, in their in their troubles. And it gets rather serious, and I think it's rather effective then. I mean, it is quite good fun, and it's very well managed by the two people. It has £10,000 in pound coins on the stage, which is always a nice thing to see, and you're picking it up in buckets and stuff like that. And they have security guards. I don't know if it was filmed every night, but I was certainly filmed on the night I went, possibly for security purposes, or possibly because just because they wanted it filmed. And it's a good, I think it's a good piece of entertainment. I'm not sure that I wouldn't rather have seen something a little bit more detailed. And actually, something that this does have the good thing where they really understand the financial system. I mean, we've seen one or two things like this. I mean, we've seen things like The Power of Yes by David Hare at the National. I think this explains the situation better than David Hare's did. But I would like to see a more sort of... it did make me want to see a more sort of substantial play on the financial crisis. I mean, we have had one or two people who've got it, but this at least clearly explains financial crisis to you, and you see the circumstances. I'd like to see that sort of combination. I mean, a lot of the time people talk about the financial crisis, but they don't really, you know, and that we should hang the bankers, but they don't really get into why we should or whether we should, because unfortunately, when I look at the financial crisis, although the bankers should shoulder a heck of a lot of blame, I don't actually feel like killing them, because I've actually looked into what they did, and what they did was behave like bankers. And it's like the scorpion and the toad. The scorpion is always the scorpion says to the toad, take me across the river. The toad says, no, you'll sting me. And the scorpion says, no, if I do that, we'll both drown. And then halfway across the river, the toad says to the scorpion, stings the toad. The toad says, well, why did you do that? And he says, well, I'm a scorpion, aren't I? And the bankers are much like the scorpions. They are, you know, you can't trust them, don't trust them, and we did. And now look where we are. I don't entirely blame the bankers. And I think this is an interesting piece. Anyway, Gareth, what did you think about this play?
I think it's a very clever way of explaining the events of the crash, and indeed the period leading up to and the period following it, really. I suspect this changes every night depending on the composition of the audience. And I, again, seem to be following parties of school kids. We had a very, very large group of school kids, and I suspect that the show had a particular exuberance, shall we say, because they were very much up for the participation, so they didn't have to work at all to get people to get involved in the games. I think it does a pretty good job of explaining, probably not as good as you think it does, but I think it does a pretty good job of explaining what actually happened. I got a few sort of problems with it, though, I think. One is that certainly the night I went, that the balance between the games and the narrative was much more towards games and not narrative, and I would have preferred that to be rebalanced a bit. And I also felt in a way that the kind of the concept swamps the play, for want of a better word, a bit. And then the contrast between the sort of, you know, the superficial end, the gamesmanship end, and the explanation end was just a bit too sharp, really, you know, between the superficial and the sort of the dry. And my final sort of reservation about it was that the end vote as an end vote was just way too simplistic. I mean, you're presented with two options and asked to vote on them. And my answer was neither, because there are at least 14 other possibilities. And I thought that was just a little bit too simplistic. But having said all of that, you know, I think that it's an excellent way to introduce theatre to young people in particular. I think it's a very clever way of tackling the financial crisis. In a way, it kind of reminded me a bit of Enron. Not that that was about the financial crisis. It was about one specific situation. But you know, it also used clever, invented ways to explain these incredibly complex concepts, really. And I kind of wonder, I mean, I really, in a way, I'd quite like to go and see it again in a different audience composition, really, just to see, you know, how it does change over the nights. The night we were there was no filming, so it clearly isn't being filmed every night. But it's, you know, it's a very, very enterprising piece of work, I think, and good to see the Bush co-producing it, I think, with this independent theatre company, and I'd certainly recommend it to people, and I have actually recommended in particular to people who I think are keep away from the theatre because they think it's a bit too dry. And I therefore thought this is a good thing to sort of say, well, have a go at this, because I think it's because that's one of the things it does very well, really. So an enjoyable evening, not groundbreaking, but an enjoyable evening, and I'm glad I went to it, really.
On the night I went, the audience were very reluctant to get involved, but that was perhaps because of the camera being there. Nick, what did you think about this play?
Well, since you brought it up, I was probably somewhere in between with my audience because I didn't have any. There weren't any school parties in my audience, but there was on the other team, which was Casino's team. There was a group of kind of early 20s lads who were really quite up for it, so they had no trouble finding volunteers. Whereas over on I was on Queenie's team, and there was and it was generally an older group who'd got in that team, so it was she had a bit more trouble dragging people out of the crowd to play the games. But yes, so obviously I think it does show it's really going to vary quite apart from the variation which is built in, which is final act kind of the play. They don't know who's going to play which part until they finish the games. But apart from the bit that's built in, there is obviously a certain amount of variation in what you're going to get depending on what the audience makeup is. But I thought this was excellent. I mean, obviously there's been so many plays that have tried to deal with a financial crisis in recent years, and I think this was one of the better ones of it, because I thought I disagree about the balance that Gareth mentioned. I thought it balanced very well. I think that the one thing that there's an element towards the end of where the story goes that's a bit weird, but and I've seen a lot of people said they weren't very impressed by that, but I think it kind of gets turned around in kind of the weirdness of it gets acknowledged and turned around a bit quite well. So it's not kind of one of the best shows you'll ever see, but it's actually it's got a uniqueness to it, certainly. I mean, just simply the fact of a pile of real money being there. And actually I think the pile of real money is in many ways it's a key to it more. I mean, obviously it makes for quite a good publicity stunt as well, but actually I think it's what it kind of defines what you come out of the show with, because I think, like I said, I've seen a lot of shows that have tried to discuss and explain or just not really understood it themselves, as you say, what's happened. Yes, I think, again, I think Enron is the closest in terms of how well I came out understanding what had happened. But this one, I think, what I really came out of was kind of, it's quite a terrifying thing, is the arbitrary value that money has. That, you know, since the loss of the gold standard, that it's, you know, money is worth everything because we've put that particular worth on it, and it can be wiped out. And it's I think it balances very well, kind of the fun of the games with the kind of the really scary thing underneath it. And I think this is kind of one of the keys of it, is that the genuine pile of money that you've got to have a security guard in there to make sure the audience don't grab a couple of handfuls on the way out, is kind of used by the end. It's being used alongside just bits of paper with a bit of like gold paper to represent even bigger amounts. It all gets mixed in with the things that are kind of worthless but have value because we say they do. And I think that's actually the thing that really comes out of this particular show. And I mean, both these actors are actors I've seen in many things before and liked, and they're just so good together. I mean, Lucy Ellenson is somebody I don't think I'd seen in anything until last year, and then suddenly she's been all over theatre in London the last year, and she's just spectacular. And there's some fantastic performances from both of them, really. And I agree. This is certainly one for people who think that, certainly anybody who thinks that, you know, theatre about serious issues has to be very dry. This is the one to show them that there's a lot more innovation out there. And again, you know, yes, a really good direction that the Bush is taking. I mean, I've said that, you know, last year I had a lot of problems with their first season, but the second one, touch wood, is really shaping up. They've you know, dealt with a lot of the issues that I had with their first season, and hopefully they're really on the track to get those audiences back in. I mean, this one has added an extra week's run, so certainly an improvement on the shows that were really struggling to find an audience.
I mean, I think Lucy Allenson and Brian Ferguson have a really, really difficult job here, because, you know, they it's kind of schizophrenic, really. I mean, they have to be game show hosts, and they have to seriously act, you know, with proper lines, and what's more, they have to switch between them. And I think they do a brilliant job, frankly, because I think it must be very, very hard to do, and I have nothing but admiration for them, particularly as, you know, on our night they had to also deal with the exuberance of the audience, you know, which must have had some sort of impact on them. And I also agree with the point you make about, you know, when they start talking about, you know, the fact that all this paper we carry around is just worthless. It's just about, you know, what we believe and trust, really. I mean, I found that really quite chilling. Actually, there was a moment when I kind of gasped and I got quite scared, and I was kind of, all of a sudden, instantly, I was going through, you know, well, what will happen to the money in my bank account then? I was kind of, you know, that really did get to me, I have to say. That was one of the moments where that really, really did get to me, and I got quite scared.
It is. I think, you know, I mean, the best of these shows about the financial crisis really do give you a chill when, you know, when you kind of get this realization that there is absolutely nothing solid behind these things. And I think it's the way they use the money as well, because, like someone mentioned earlier, it's people running backwards and forwards across the stage with buckets full of money. It's, and, you know, it's little sandcastle building buckets for children, and they're, you know, the value of money is counted in terms of the games in buckets worth of money. And this is the thing, it's just there's just coins all over the place by the end. It's just discarded. I mean, there must be quite a job to make sure they've picked them all up from the little nooks and crannies under the seats by the end, to make sure there's still 10,000 at the end of the night, because it is really treated, you know, the way the cash is treated, it is really shows you the, you know, it's treated in the same way you would any other prop that could be disposable. So that is really quite chilling.
And of course, it was a mere fraction of what the real hedge fund managers were actually dealing with.
Millions
of pounds. I mean, we had a debate. So it was quite interesting over dinner afterwards. We had a sort of, first of all, we weren't convinced there were 10,000 £1 coins there. But I think after a while, you know, because they didn't look like 10,000. But after a while, you know, we sort of came to the conclusion, yes, there was. But it did actually generate a really interesting sort of discussion over dinner afterwards, really, that not just on the piece of theatre, but also on the issues that it raised, and funny moments and chilling moments in that as well, really.
Yeah. But, no, I think it was, because I got my bit of audience participation out of the way early. I volunteered to be the one to check that it was actual real money. And I agree that you just looked at that pile and it did not look like £10,000, but up close, when you're checking it, you think, actually, that this probably is what they say it is.
It might be worth saying that when you're split into teams before you meet up in the middle, you have to choose. It's called a unique talent, isn't it?
Yes.
From amongst the group. And in my group, we were down to about two options in the end, and the two options were rapping a particular song, which the name of which now escapes me, and the other option was somebody who could put their tongue up their nose. And we actually ended up choosing, thank God, we actually ended up choosing the rap. I didn't actually think the execution of the unique talents was that good, to be honest. But a very clever idea, I think, to start the show to do that. I think that's a very clever idea to start the show.
Yes, you get this little team meet up with whoever your team leader is, kind of beforehand, before you go in. Our team had someone who could say the entire alphabet backwards in under 4 seconds.
Oh, right.
The other team fielded a woman who could do a sort of backwards flip gymnastic thing that she called a spider something something, and I kind of considered it cheating, because they went, can anybody from your team do this, and I don't think any of us had any idea what we were actually being asked to do until we saw what she'd done. So for all I know, maybe three women in the team could have done it as well.
But, I think it shows, I think the age of the audience kind of determines what you get, really. So clearly, yes, us getting a dance move and a rap would tell you the composition of the
audience. Now I'm going to talk about London Wall by John Van Druten, which is on at the Finborough Theatre. This play, written in 1931, had an original production which featured a very young John Mills as the office boy. He's sort of a comic relief in this. It's set in a solicitor's office on London Wall, and it mainly deals with a group of four women who are all secretaries to the firm, and chiefly with the relationship between the oldest and the youngest. One fears that she might have got into a rut at the office, and the other is kind of unsure whether to carry on with her her shy boyfriend from the office downstairs, or to encourage the rather caddish, roguish lounge lizard of the junior solicitor who actually manages the office.
I thought this was really good. I saw it the night after I'd seen Quatermain's Terms, which hadn't impressed me very much, and it was another kind of period drama set in a workplace, and I found it such a breath of fresh air compared to that. It kind of feels very forward thinking for its time, because it's very much focused on the experience of women in the workplace, and you really kind of see that these are they're women who kind of have opportunities that the generation before them certainly didn't have, but doesn't mean things have moved on kind of in leaps and bounds. They still really need to get married if they're not going to get stuck in that job all their lives, because there's no room for promotion for them. I mean, as you say, they're secretary, and that's all they can be. So it shows kind of a really a very interesting generation for female workers that is kind of this. I suppose a really kind of pioneering generation who had these freedoms, but really had to, it was that they couldn't kind of make a career yet. So it's kind of an interesting piece of history that I don't think people really know much about. And it's another one of these plays that Neil McPherson digs up so many of them at the Finborough, which actually was quite a big hit in its day, and for kind of a decade or two was regularly produced, and now this is I think the first production in my lifetime. So and seeing some of the sort of plays that get revived regularly, you do wonder how some of these really excellent ones fall down the cracks. And it's a very well acted production. As you say, there's the two central women are the oldest, Miss Janus, which is Alex Dunmore. She's very moving in her. She's kind of the big, by kind of default, is kind of the mother figure to the other secretaries, but she's actually, her own private life is at the very least as much of a mess as the others. And Pat, who's played by Maya Alexander, is she's the younger girl who's quite recently joined the office, and she's kind of fallen a bit for the charms of Mr. Brewer. He's played by Alex Robertson. He's the kind of rather slimy office manager who's trying to have his way with as many of the girls as possible. And I think that it's quite interestingly played, because she has she does have a romantic interest of her own who works in the office downstairs, and kind of it's but I think it's interesting that it's played that what really attracts her to this kind of sleazy bloke in the office is that he actually pays attention to her, whereas the guy she actually likes is too shy to barely speak to her. So there's all kinds of stuff going on in there. There's lots of kind of little plot lines. Everybody in the cast has got something to do. There's a nice little turn from David Whitworth, who plays the head of the chambers, who's he's sort of the sympathetic old boss, but at the same time he's really kind of incredibly blunt to the point of tactlessness and rudeness. So he's quite a fun character to have in there. So it's really one of these great little plays that has so much to enjoy while you're watching it, and then kind of leaves you with possibly an understanding of a certain little period of history and a little corner of history that often gets overshadowed, because obviously so much else going on while in trying to rebuild the country after the First World War. One of the things you forget is the change in employment for women and how exactly that panned out. It's not, it's not an overnight thing, being able to compete in the same way with men. So it's certainly well worth seeing, I think.
Yeah, and it also forms an interesting companion piece to a thing they did last year, the Finbro, which is Cornelius, which was by J.B. Priestley.
Yes.
Play. I mean, obviously, it's a completely different focus, but it's a rather interesting sort of pit that they've picked both of those plays. I'm trying to think. Jonathan Van Druten is a name I've heard of, and as you say, they are they're sort of the playwrights that were discarded when the Angry Young Men came in, and we're discovering now that they kind of shouldn't have been discarded quite so quickly. There was that kind of saying, no, we'll throw everything. We just threw absolutely everything out, and one or two of the really good bits and pieces we lost, I think.
Yeah, it's I'm a Camera. You've probably heard him from that was the basis for Cabaret. John Van Druten.
Yeah, and they had a production of that at the.
They did, yes. Just about a few months ago. Yeah, so that's. I knew I'd seen the name recently, and that's what it was. But we've had. Certainly that generation.
People like Rattigan and certain.
That was where I was trying to go, and I got lost. Yes, certainly the thing that with that generation, the first thing I think of is Rattigan, who in the last couple of years has suddenly really had this resurgence, and really people have gone, wow, he's a really good writer. But yes, there was famously in his case, you had the Angry Young Men, and one in particular kind of making it their mission to kind of get rid of him. I think maybe off the back of that, there is kind of this realization that there were other talented writers out there, and there's some good plays that kind of got chucked by the wayside.
We're now going to talk about One Touch of Venus, which is on in the Wilds of Walthamstow at the old Rose and Crown Theatre. It's a rather interesting-looking play. You've got music by Kurt Weill and lyrics by Ogden Nash, with a book by Ogden Nash and S.J. Perelman. It's about, a statue of Venus, of Anatolia, so not so presumably one with arms. It comes to New York, and it's then touched. It is touched by a naive young barber called Rodney, and it comes to life. And she fixates on him, and Venus fixates on him, and pursues him all over New York. It's apparently a deliberately farcical version of Pygmalion. So it sounds quite good fun. Now, John, was it as much fun?
It was an enormous amount of fun, and on paper it just shouldn't be, because these are three collaborators who really never ought to have come together. You have the sort of American poet and kind of absurdist humorist Ogden Nash, Sid Perelman, who'd been writing sort of sharp one-liners for Broadway and for Hollywood for years, and then Kurt Weill, who married these people, because Kurt Weill, obviously is best known for his kind of Weimar Republic and collaborations with Brecht in 30s Berlin, but then of course escaping the oncoming storm in Germany by 1943, when One Touch of Venus was written, he'd emigrated, and he deliberately set out to study American musical theatre and jazz. And for some, I suppose he must have had social introductions, but he actively sought out Ira Gershwin and Oscar Hammerstein and got them to teach him what this kind of musical theatre was about. So it's nothing like what you might call Kurt Weill music, because it's tuneful and it's upbeat and it's melodic and it's extended. It's not like a lot of the sort of snatches of melody that you get in the darker, vile stuff. And it works extraordinarily well. And you begin to ask yourself, why has it not been performed for all these years? Because this is less a revival than a rediscovery. I think there might have been a version of it at Edinburgh a few years ago, but you just don't hear of it being regularly performed. Not even on that kind of relentless American summer stock and college circuit. If you Google it, there are very, very few versions that are available to see what people did with it. But at Walthamstow, I think they have done it extremely well. I think Lydia Milman-Schmidt, who is one of the two or three resident young directors there, she is an American, and I think she has understood this work extremely well, and she's delivered a very, very polished and beautiful elevation of it. And I'm sure Gareth will talk in more detail, but there are two outstanding performances. Again, an American girl called Kendra McMillan, who plays the Venus figurine who comes to life. And she is statuesque in a lot of ways. She's quite tall, and she's quite traditionally voluptuous and elegant. But she also has, as the character, has a really wicked tongue and a sharp wit and a very jaundiced view of humans, really. And she's partnered by a young man who I've only seen once before, when he played one of the jumpers in Stobart's Jumpers at the Tabard, and I'm struggling for his name. The character
Douglas.
Tell me again.
David J. Douglas.
Yes, I don't know why all these boys have three names. It must be like the Kennel Club. They're running out of names for actors, like they are for dogs. But he's quite dog-like in a way. It's quite an appropriate metaphor, because he's very spaniel-like as far as Venus is concerned. But he's also a bit hangdog as well. He's a bit of a, we call him a loser nowadays. But he's a wonderful embodiment of those kind of underdog characters played wonderfully by Jerry Lewis or by Robert Morse. I was thinking Robert Morse, yes, from How to Succeed in Business. That kind of schmuck who you don't think will get the girl, and he does. And it's maybe not too much to say he gets the girl, he loses the girl, but he gets the girl in the end, you know, as in all the best musicals. Really, really terrific. I find it hard to fault it. It's a difficult play to stage, because it requires quite a complicated set, which has also been very well done. But I think I said in my review that I felt that the Rosencrown had come of age with this. It's a better quality production and a cleverer production than the many, many things I've seen there before. A very, very high standard of singing and acting and staging.
Gareth, what did you think about it?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. This, for me, is certainly the best. I mean, I've been watching this venue and going to this venue for a few years now, and this is unquestionably the best thing they've put on so far. I've actually seen the show before, because Opera North mounted the show about 10 years ago, and I think I saw it in Nottingham when they were touring. And, you know, Opera North, with all the resources they have, didn't do it as well as this. This is a fringe theatre with a budget that probably, you know, Opera North spend on skirts on a Friday or something. And they, you know, they've done a really very, very good job of it. The design, as John said, by Sarah June Mills is excellent. It's just very clever, because it's just a kind of gallery space. But without spoiling it, it does need to sort of play a few tricks, really. And it does that very well. And Lydia Milman-Schmidt, I think, really has staged it extremely well on that space. It's quite a small space and quite a lot of actors. And in the second act, there's a kind of ballet, as we used to call them in musicals, really. And Rhiannon Faith, as the choreographer, has really managed to create a really very good ballet in a very tiny space, really. So all of the production values are very high. But what makes it stand out for me is the musical standards of it, because we have, Aaron Klingham, who's both the director of the producing company there and indeed the MD of virtually every show they have there, just plays this whole thing on a piano. And then he's got, you know, he's got a I didn't really think there was a bad voice in the cast at all, really. I thought they were all very good. And I thought it was sung very, very well. It doesn't have that many standards. There's really only one standard, I think, which is the song Speak Low. But it's actually a very, very good score. Even though nothing kind of jumps out at you. It's actually consistently very good as a score. And as John said, you know, the girl who plays the lead role, I mean, Kendra McMillan is excellent. David J. Douglas is excellent. I'd also pick out, there's a gallery owner called Savory, and James Wolstenholm, I thought, played that very well. And he has a secretary who's also played extremely well by Daniel Morris.
Yes.
It's, you know, those for me were the sort of the four performances that made the show. But I have to say, I thought, you know, there wasn't really a fault in the whole of the ensemble. It's a bit of a daft story, you know. I mean, it's about a statue that comes alive in a gallery in New York. But they've really done something very, very good with it. And I was captivated, really, from beginning to end. You know, and it's, if you think of the musicals being written around that time in the 40s and 50s, this is just very different. And I suppose it would be, wouldn't it? Because, you know, it was this man who'd escaped from the Nazis and he's bound to do something differently, really. So I thought it was great to see the show again. And I think they've done a fabulous job with it. And I would love to see it move again. The last show I think I saw there was Flora the Red Menace, which ended up with a second outing in the Landor in Clapham. And I'd love this to get another outing somewhere else as well, really, because I think it's showing off this company, All Star Productions, and this venue to great effect. So absolutely to be recommended. I don't know how long it's got to run, probably another week and probably not much more, but absolutely to be recommended.
23rd of February.
Right, so one more week. So I think, you know, to be seen, really.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as-yet-unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayu-londontheatre.org, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.